From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Just as there is a national conversation around defunding the police, as we see the human toll of a domestic war by law enforcement against people of color, some have begun linking that idea to defunding the U.S. military. After all, we spend a massive chunk of our federal dollars to outfit troops and purchase weapons of mass destruction, which are mostly used to terrorize and bomb people of color in other nations. Nations like Afghanistan, where the U.S.'s longest war continues, slipping in and out of the American public's consciousness. Now a veteran of the longest official war in U.S. history, has written a scathing indictment of that never-ending battle. Writing in his new book, Un-American, author Eric Edstrom says, "In American parlance, never forget is tacitly and exclusively reserved for Americans to serve in their role as righteous victims, never as aggressors. Instead," writes Edstrom, "let us never forget the far larger costs of America's permanent war posture and realize that humanity's greatest problems will not be solved by the military." Eric Edstrom is a West Point graduate, and the full title of his book is Un-American, A Soldier's Reckoning of Our Longest War. Welcome to the program, Eric.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's very good to be here.
What led you toward writing this book? I imagine just going through this war in person, this might have been a way for you to grapple with probably the biggest experience in your life?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's an aspect of it that is catharsis, which is sharing this experience with a wider audience. But I think that there's also an element of feeling compelled to write it. And that's partially due to the fact that there aren't a lot of veterans who are sharing this message frequently or loudly enough. So over the years, as I sort of progressed and with the mercy of distance and time, spent a little bit more time thinking about those experiences I had in direct conflict and still wanted to say something about it years later.
Why don't you read for our audience a section from your book so they get a sense of where you're coming from on this war?
Sure. So this comes from the first chapter entitled Three Visions. The military is America's sacrosanct institution. Condemning America's use of political violence is viewed somewhere closer to treason than free speech. Part of this is the blinkered, either you are with us or you are with the terrorists, false dichotomy of the post-9/11 era. We have not outgrown it. Since it is comfortable to believe that U.S. foreign policy is always in support of freedom and the peace process, it follows that anyone who opposes U.S. foreign policy opposes freedom and the peace process. America is not morally infallible. And this war, the global war on terrorism, has been a deep stain on our nation's claim to be an upstanding force for good. However, I've encountered resentment when I shared my thoughts and opinions based on firsthand experiences. One person, a member of my own family, caustically remarked, quote, "It's only because of better men that you have the freedom to spew this anti-American garbage." I found this vitriol particularly rich, given that this person never served a day in uniform. If I am not given permission to express my opposition to the war in which I fought, who is? How American? How many metric units of American do you need to be before you are able to condemn state actions?
Eric Edstrom is my guest, reading from his new book, Un-American, A Soldier's Reckoning of Our Longest War. Your book is quite visceral, and I imagine that's because, of course, you have experienced that war firsthand. And you start out by asking the reader to imagine their own death and then imagine it from the perspective of the other side. Why? Why do you start with death?
So I think that people would change their tune if they had skin in the game. I think that people would change their tune if they could empathize with the other side. And when I was thinking about how I wanted to lay out the book, I wrote this preface, and it felt honestly like it was the first piece of sort of real writing I had done in my life, to be honest. And, you know, if you focus on really what it feels like to be there in the moment as an individual, the same way that a soldier like myself or my platoon was, and you imagined what it would be like to step on an IED, if you're not willing to personally die in the conflict, my encouragement to the American public is not to encourage anyone else to die for that conflict either, because ultimately at the end of the day, soldiers will die for this and people on the other side will die for this. So if you're not willing to do it, don't push that issue. The second component is imagining the other side, which if you were to imagine the birth lottery allocated you to grow up in Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria, and in the case of Afghanistan, where we've been occupying their country for 19 years, how would you feel about having these invaders stay there, point weapons at you, occasionally, you know, assassinate a wedding party by accident because the, you know, Air Force drone controller might have thought it was a Taliban gathering, or an Arkansas National Guard unit, which I, you know, was around when I was there in 2009 and 2010, ended up shooting up a civilian bus because the young machine gunner in the back of the convoy thought the bus was a threat, which, if he was well-trained enough, would know that that would not be the case.
You say that your attitude toward the war on terror shifted radically, and it took a while for you to get where you are now, and that you got swept up in the hysteria, and I believe that was the word that you used, the hysteria of the times after September 11th, 2001, and those terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. Were there particular instances in your experience in the war that slowly chipped away at your sense of idealism about the U.S., or was there one turning point?
That's a great question. I think it was progressive, really. You know, I alluded to just a second ago to the Arkansas National Guard shooting the bus. And when you actually investigate it, rather than just take the military letter at face value with the press release that says that they were completely justified, when you dig into it a bit more and you realize that if you actually wanted to stop this bus, this passenger bus full of people, rather than shooting into the cabin of the bus, which is what the machine gunner did, presumably if you actually thought it was a real threat, you would want it to stop. So you could shoot out the tires, you could shoot the engine block, you could even, you know, potentially shoot the driver if that was the level of fear that you felt and that was somehow justifiable. But what you saw was a machine gunner that fired dozens of rounds into the passenger cabin of this bus. And essentially what the military did was sweep it under the carpet. No Afghans are meaningfully consulted during this process when these things happen. And usually you have a military officer investigating another military officer or soldiers. So that's as far as it goes. And I learned that a lot of the things that happen in combat will never be known about by the American public more broadly. And a second example is when I personally was in a grape field with some of my soldiers. We had been babysitting this road for 15 hours at a time. It was literally called Operation Highway Babysitter. And the way it worked was sort of like this, where you would patrol the road to ensure that the resupply convoys would be able to give food and petrol to the small outposts that we were occupying so that we could continue patrolling the road so that they could continue providing supplies to us in perpetuity ad nauseum. But what was happening during the course of this is that insurgents were still able to slip in IEDs because wherever you are not patrolling is a prime spot for them to put in the next IED, and it's impossible to be everywhere all the time to make that stop. So in any event, I was given a call that there had been some small arms fire along this highway, and my platoon and I went over to this grape field and dismounted from our vehicles to go in to speak to these men that looked unarmed initially. We didn't see any weapons on them, and we entered into the field, and we probably made it about 15 steps before the grape field sort of erupted in small arms fire around us. And very quickly, myself and the rest of my soldiers started to hunker down behind crumbly little bits of mud wall, and were engaged in this quite serious ambush. And eventually, you know, you get fire superiority because we have more weapons and our trucks and everything else to bring to the fight. And it seemed as though the insurgents were starting to break contact, at which point a pair of Kiowa helicopters came on station to help us out because they knew that we had been in contact and they were in the area. And I radioed over and spoke to them and said, hey, this is the general direction where they had departed to. We're still getting shot at a little bit, but we're not entirely sure where they are. The helicopter said, Roger that, you know, we'll check it out. So from that point, we could not see what they were seeing. And what unfolded in front of me was that these two Kiowa helicopters went on a series of gun runs where they fired all of their weapons to point of being Winchester or all out, where they fired all of their rockets, all of their 50 caliber machine gun rounds at a series of mud buildings. And what I learned later when I returned back to the main base from my platoon sergeant was that soldiers and the senior leadership in my battalion were watching this incident unfold via an unarmed drone. And this unarmed drone, basically like a video game, flew over the top and saw what was happening. And in that recording, they saw that the OH-58 helicopters had killed unarmed civilians. And when I returned back to the base to find out what happened, I learned that it was reported on the battle damage assessment in the reports as unknown. Wow. So they did not claim that they killed any civilians. They said it was, quote, unknown, even though they could verify with footage, which must exist somewhere out there, that this thing happened. I raised the issue to my battalion commander. Nothing was done about it. Nothing was done about it by my company commander. No investigation, to the best of my knowledge, ever happened during the course of the rest of that deployment. And it was swept under the rug and nothing else happened. So from that point forward, I was thoroughly disillusioned with this notion that we are the good guys. And it became very clear to me in this moment of awakening that if I had grown up in Afghanistan, if the birth lottery put me there, I could understand why a different version of me would be joining the insurgency to fight me, to kill me.
Which brings me to that second part of your book, which we just don't hear about often enough from Americans, which is to imagine ourselves as Afghans, as the targets of our war. It is just something that we tend to discount. Even when there are anti-war sentiments, they're often cast only in terms of the toll on American soldiers. So tell me about your experiences with Afghans and how you tried to put yourself in their place. You were mentioning earlier that you were babysitting this road in order to get supplies, but had you not been there, there would be no point to babysitting the road. If there were no American soldiers in Afghanistan, we wouldn't be talking about American soldiers being killed.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. It's again, this cycle, and there's many news articles out there that describe that same thing. My first sort of experiences with native people of Afghanistan, people that were born and raised and grew up there, were my interpreters. And I had a interpreter assigned to my platoon basically every single day, and they would sometimes rotate throughout that entire sort of 12-month tour. And during that time, you start to learn more about these individuals, but also about the culture more broadly. And I started to feel like when we were in the vehicles and some of my soldiers might say some sort of ignorant or racist comment to the interpreter, that this is just something that they endured, and it was uncomfortable. And over the period of time that you're there, you realize that there is this sort of dehumanization of, quote, the other side. And it works a bit like this, where in order to be in war and in order to take a rifle and hold it up to your shoulder, look through the optics, and try to find someone on the other side, another human being, and be willing to pull the trigger until the blood rivers out of their body. In order to do that, you need to mentally and emotionally believe that this other person is, quote, the enemy, and that in some way that enemy is killable, and that this is a human being who you are allowed to kill. And in order to do that, there is this element of sort of dehumanization that goes on, aside from sort of terms of abuse and name calling. There's sort of this sense of, oh, these are all incompetent people. And this sort of is a pervasive notion that filters through various army units at times. And when you realize that, you know, if the enemy is absolute evil and killable, when you realize that a large part of the population of Afghanistan is helping them out, helping out the insurgents against us in one way or another, it's sometimes just a matter of degree. Well, then sometimes that anger and that frustration bleeds across to a much larger group of people, which then you are basically stereotyping and taking a paintbrush that's 1,000 miles wide to paint these people with one color. And if the enemy is killable and these other folks are helping them out, well, then they're sort of the enemy. And therefore, you know, it's very easy to, on a slippery slope, to think that everyone is sort of evil. And that is where you get this these attitudes of sort of American supremacy in some ways over there. And it's disheartening.
Let's talk about the costs of the war. We have spent huge amounts of money on the Afghanistan war. There's very little to actually show for that. We started our conversation, I referred to this idea that has now pervaded the United States, that we might start questioning the huge funding that we give to police departments in the United States. And very, very slowly, people are starting to question the funding of the U.S. military. A big chunk of our tax dollars go toward funding the military. Of that, a big chunk just gets swallowed up in these wars that have no end in sight. We've had president after president move the goalposts on what would constitute success in the Afghanistan war in particular. How do you explain the sinkhole of tax dollars that the Afghanistan war has become?
It's truly inexplicable, Sonali. One of the lines I use in the book is that there's never been a time in American history where more was spent accomplishing less. And, soldiers realize this too. There's a website called Duffelblog, which is sort of like The Onion. And they talk about many of these issues from sort of a tongue-in-cheek soldier perspective. And one of the quotes that I put into the book is something to the effect of, this new commander has big shoes to fill. Two presidents and the last 17 commanders before him have already claimed to have made progress and won the war. And that is sort of, to some extent, what has happened. To give you sort of an eye into the costs, I can do a couple different things. First of all, just explain the top line stuff and then get into an example of graft and waste. So for starters, Brown University describes the cost of war currently as about $6.4 trillion, which is such a large number, it's almost unfathomable. But you can put that into context using other very large things as well. So for what can you get for $6.4 trillion? Well, for starters, you could pay off all student debt in the United States quite easily, because that's only $1.5 trillion. So then you have quite a bit left. Well, you could also pay off all credit card debt in the United States, and that's about $1.1 trillion. Still, you have the majority of your money. Well, if you really wanted to get outlandish and start spending it on completely stupid things, you could take rubber band stacks of $100 bills, you know, a $10,000 brick, and lay these bricks of money, literally bricks of money, end to end, and go around the entire circumference of the globe. But don't worry, you still have money left over, where you would be able to have a private Beyonce concert every single day for the next 3,600 years. And that is the effective cost, not including servicing those debts, for the amortized cost of the war on terror. And it's absolutely shocking. One of the things that I point out in that third part of the book, which needs to be raised because, you know, often things are covered under the umbrella of, quote, defense or national security. Well, in my opinion, national security, if we want to look at it as doing things that reduce harm to ordinary American people rather than just sexy, shiny military equipment, well, then it takes on a much broader sense. And national security would include things like healthcare. It would include things like financial resiliency. So if you did come into something like a pandemic, that you would be able to offer something more than $1,200 once. You'd be able to offer this several times to basically maintain a level of welfare for the American public. So, you know, that is one component there. Shifting gears into sort of the costs from a personal perspective, one of the things that the United States military really likes to do and talk about quite frequently is the notion that we are building schools. Well, it sounds great on paper. And if you actually want to build a school, it's probably worth assessing sort of the costs and the benefits of what that entails. Well, for starters, we were working with sort of a nefarious Afghan warlord who owned his subsidiary construction company. And what we would do is basically take, again, bricks of $100 bills given to the construction company to build a mud and cinder block school. Now, he would use this school as a power grabbing device, and it would help him earn many other cost plus projects from the Department of Defense elsewhere, whether it's emptying latrines or filling sandbags or whatever it is. And he would take a huge cut of that and become extremely, extremely rich. Well, there's also other costs because actually operating in Afghanistan is prohibitively expensive. To get a gallon of gasoline to a remote outpost in Afghanistan, you have to think about the whole value chain. And, you know, you can literally fly it in. You know, maybe it goes from Qatar to Kabul, finally to Kandahar. And from Kandahar, it's either trucked out with a convoy of armed security that you pay for, or it's perhaps flown by Chinook helicopter as a fuel blivet that's dropped off. And in some cases, the fully burdened cost of gasoline getting to its end destination can be $400 a gallon.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, don't worry. We're not done. There's so much more here. And you know, if you're operating with a platoon of 28 soldiers during the course of the 4, 5, 6 months that it takes to build this school, well, you're paying all their paychecks plus hazardous duty pay and everything else. Maybe a couple of these vehicles get blown up by IEDs that, you know, you can't protect against. Well, the vehicles cost, you know, roughly $1 million a piece, so there's a couple million. The soldiers that are in the vehicle may have, you know, an amputation or a traumatic brain injury. They are going to go back to the United States and have health care, get paid disability for the rest of their life. And Harvard Kennedy School tallies some of these costs at being $2 million over the lifetime of one of those injured soldiers, depending on the type of injury. So there you have, you know, $2, $4, $6 million for a few different injured soldiers. And then, you know, well, maybe you need to call in close air support because there's, you know, some insurgents that are shooting at you. Well, the operating cost for a fixed wing aircraft, you know, is sort of between $30,000 and $60,000 per aircraft per hour. So you're burning through that. You very easily could have sent all of your entire platoon of infantrymen to university with room and board and living stipend for, you know, one single mission in many cases. And we do hundreds of missions during the course of this deployment. And in the end, you've built this, you know, this mud and cinder block school. It's filled with spiders. There's no running water. The teacher shows up occasionally and is semi-literate. The quality of the education probably comes dangerously close to finger painting. And, you know, if you really wanted to take care of these children and give them a good education without injuring anybody, here's a different solution, which is the U.S. government could literally buy a used Gulfstream 4 jet, load the dozen or two dozen children that ordinarily would have gone to that school into that jet, fly it off to Groton or Eton or Andover or Milton Academy or any of these fancy private boarding schools that go for nearly $60,000 a year for tuition, pay for all of their room and board. And then once they're off the plane, take a couple satchels of money, $1 million in each briefcase, put them on the jet, fill it with high explosives, and blow it up on the tarmac. That is a cheaper solution for a better education for those children, and nobody died for it. And that is the ludicrous cost of what it is like operating in Afghanistan.
I want to wrap up our conversation by asking you to go back to where we started, which is how you started with this war. You were a graduate of West Point, the most prestigious military academy in the country, and the reluctance on the part of the American public as a whole to question our military spending and question these wars that are so far away from us that we don't have to see up close what you've seen comes from the perpetuation of the myth of America as fighting for good, preserving our freedoms. Every year around Veterans Day and 4th of July, we hear these notions that soldiers who've died for our freedoms are the reason why we have the freedoms that we do now. How much of a cultural shift needs to happen in this country in order for us to have this critical mass to defunding the military, to ending these wars?
A huge cultural shift. Huge. And I would say that I've lived in the UK for 2 years. I've lived in Australia for 5 years. Other countries do not maintain the same weird, perverse fetish that with the military as the United States has with its military.
And they have better healthcare, better schools. They are doing things about the climate. They are better prepared for pandemics.
In many cases, yes. That's very true. And, one of the things I mentioned in the book, which I think needs to be broken, is this notion that military service by itself is an absolute good. And what I mean by that is, just for the sake of comparison, when we think of public services, and especially if you're a teenage boy when you're in high school thinking about what you want to do, oftentimes the sort of paradigm or thing that enters your head is, I want to do something helpful for society. And then the thing that gets told to you is sort of, well, you should join the military. That's a great way to do it. But because it's not an absolute good, if you consider, for instance, if you become a firefighter, and you become better at fighting fires, well, presumably the community is better off. More fires are being put out. They're being put out faster. The same is probably true if you become a teacher. If you become better at teaching, presumably the community is better off. But if you join the military and you become better at shooting people in the face and occupying a foreign land, in many cases, they are not better off. The other American soldiers around you are not better off. In fact, you could say that in many cases, you probably exacerbate the exact problem you're trying to fix, which is terrorism, because you're creating a tremendous amount of ill will, endangering American security, not protecting it, and wasting trillions of dollars. So it needs to be thought about not as an absolute good, but every single time the United States says we should use our military, that needs to be the highest level of investigation, because the chances that you can do a tremendous amount of harm is very high if it's used inappropriately. And the United States very rarely, if you think about the history of the United States, how many times has the United States military actually been used in a conflict to defend the borders of our national territory?
Right.
The War of 1812, Pearl Harbor with an asterisk because it wasn't even a state at that time. It was annexed from the Native Hawaiians. And September 11th, everything else is the use of political violence and force elsewhere. So in many cases, it falls under the umbrella we talk about as defense, but really it's offense. And we need to be extremely careful about that and avoid wars of aggression. War is fundamentally extremely inefficient, extremely harmful, and many times counterproductive. So those are some of the things that I think about when trying to change the culture. And I hope it happens. I feel like there's a murmur and a change. I think that when I look at sort of the cultural norms of, George W. Bush era times when I was at West Point, it was completely taboo to question that. And since the book has come out, I've had some really thoughtful West Pointers and recent graduates, you know, class of 2018, that said, you know, thank you for writing this. There is a silent majority within the military that thinks about it in this way, and we need to have a huge cultural shift of the way we're using it.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you for adding to the cultural paradigm change that might be unfolding with your book. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Eric Edstrom. He's a West Point graduate, a veteran of the Afghanistan War. We've been discussing his book, Un-American, A Soldier's Reckoning of Our Longest War. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.